You know how you make America great again? Tell Donald Trump to go to hell.
What is your reaction to hearing what Donald Trump says?
Disgusted. He is helping the enemy of this nation. He is empowering radical Islam. And if he knew anything about the world at all, you would know that most Muslims like this ideology, and they've died in by the thousands trying to combat this radical ideology. You're undercutting their efforts. You're slandering their sacrifice. You're marginalizing what they're trying to do to make the world a better place. He's a race-baiting, xenophobic, religious bigot. He doesn't represent my party. He doesn't represent the values that the men and women who wear the uniform are fighting for.
On a recent town hall for the Republican contenders for the nomination, all three of them, that would be Cruz, Trump, and Kasich, all said that they will not pledge to support the eventual Republican nominee. In my opinion, Trump has peaked and is going to begin losing some states. It doesn't mean he's not going to win anymore, but he's more likely to start losing states. And I think more folks are going to start taking a look at Ted Cruz. Understand this. It doesn't matter which one of these nitwits the Republicans decide to pick. They're both racists. They're both homophobes. They're both xenophobes. And as if the party hasn't been ripping itself apart for years, these guys are only further ripping it apart.
Well, I'm not disappointed. I've warned against this. I mean, you go back on my shows on Fox, and I warned the progressive movement. And that's what this is. This is Donald Trump is a progressive. Make no mistake.
Donald Trump is a progressive. Make no mistake about it. So you know whose fault this is. This is the Democrats' fault. Donald Trump is a progressive, and this is all the Democrats' fault. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 154. My name is Melvin, and man alive, am I hot today. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for your continued support. And today, I really want to get into racism. Now, we cover this topic a lot on this show, but recently, the violence at Trump rallies has gotten pretty out of control. And Trump has been asked about it, and Trump says, what? There's no violence. There's any violence in my rally. Hey, sometimes people get a little bit impassioned. Sometimes people get a little bit hot. But there's not any violence in my rallies. Who got hit? Who got hit in my rallies? And here's another thing. What you say from the stage does have a real-world effect. And what's happening up there on Donald Trump's stage? And although we'd like to give Ted Cruz a pass, what Ted Cruz has said, although he doesn't necessarily say it so much at rallies like Donald Trump does, what Ted Cruz is saying on television, on radio, and to his supporters is also leading to actual physical violence, not just at the Trump rally, but in the streets of America. This from USNews.com. Dr. Prabhat Singh is a husband, a father, and a professor of medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. Just 33, he serves in prestigious positions, including director of the Arnold Institute for Global Health and vice chairman of medicine for population health at the Mount Sinai Health System. He co-founded the 1 Million Community Health Worker Campaign with Jeffrey Sachs, a leading force in the war on poverty. Singh was the founding technical advisor for the Harlem-based City Health Works, which trains locally hired healthcare coaches to improve the community's health. As a Sikh, that's S-I-K-H. Now, with respect to this word, I pronounce it Sikh. I've heard other folks pronounce it sick. I can't do it that way because of what the word sick means in English. So I'm going to go with Sikh just so you'll know what I'm talking about. Kind of like when we talk about the Koch brothers, we say Coke, K-O-C-H, not C-O-K-E like the soda. So Mr. Singh is a Sikh, and as part of his religion, he wears a turban and a long beard. And in 2013, a group of about 20 men in Central Park saw him and his brother out for a walk and came to a single conclusion, which they shouted at the accomplished doctor and academic terrorist. They attacked Singh and fractured his jaw, all because they apparently thought that he was a Muslim. And while Muslims and Sikhs practice different religions and come from different cultures, Singh is more concerned about what he sees as a frightened commonality of two faiths, an increasingly emboldened hatred fueled by fear of terrorism and ignorance about religious tenets. Quote, whether someone thinks that we're Sikhs or Muslims is immaterial. Singh was a Columbia professor, a Columbia University professor at the time of the attack. What is clear is that it's a more hostile environment, more hostile than I remember in college after 9/11. With a presidential campaign dominated by candidates who speak openly about shuttering mosques and building a wall between the U.S. and Mexico and making refugee applicants take a religious test, the danger is more widespread for religious minorities. The difference today is that the hostility is animus and more naked. It's more permitted and part of a community, media, and political discourse. So what happened to him, because it happened back in 2013, was not necessarily, or actually, excuse me, not at all, the fault of the Trump campaign or the Cruz campaign. Since 9/11, there has been a hotbed of hatred in America for Muslims. We blame Muslims for everything. And yes, some of the Saudis that carried out the 9/11 attacks were Muslim. And there have been other attacks carried out since then. But the reasons for terrorism, we're not going to get into them too much here. But understand this, we have terrorism on our shores because we brought terrorism to their shores. What are you saying? Are you saying there are brave men and women who wear the uniform of terrorists? No! Absolutely not! But U.S. foreign policy is now, as it has been for a long time, a source of terrorism. And the way I can justify that is when you go into these other countries and when you do things in what are considered holy lands that they don't want you doing, such as drinking alcohol, dressing immodestly, things of that nature, or just going into their lands and killing their people. Because you're just there looking for terrorists, you can't say, well, when they come to our shores, now it's a problem. No, it was a problem before. There's ways to deal with terrorism, and clearly we're not going to be able to get into them today because it's only a one-hour show. But what I do want to highlight on this show is how out of whack we've become since we've been hit, how we've managed to do all the wrong things since we've been hit, and how now we're going after anybody with a beard and a headscarf because we're afraid. We're afraid of each other, we're afraid of ourselves, and we're afraid of the other. So with the campaign raging hot right now, with plenty of racism and cultural hatred, these attacks have made their untriumphant return. Quote, a few days after Christmas, a Sikh man in Fresno, California, was hit by a truck and further attacked by the truck's occupants, who yelled, "Why are you here?" to the 68-year-old man. Earlier in December, a Sikh house of worship in Orange County was defaced with obscene graffiti containing a reference to the Islamic State group, suggesting that the violators connected the Sikhs with terrorism from Islam. Simranjeet Singh, a religion professor at Trinity University in Texas, says he's a Texas scholar and has his foot in both realms. He's a Sikh and he teaches the Quran and the study of Islam. His students often mistake him for a Muslim at first because of his appearance. He says some openly acknowledge coming to the class with some biases against Islam, which clearly comes from our media. Biases he strives to undo as the class delves into the teachings of the religion itself. Quote, ignorance and illiteracy are one aspect of the problem, he says. The second part of that problem, I think, is the political rhetoric and the political landscape that we are creating a sense of fear in our communities. The difference now is that given the way political leaders are speaking, it has become all okay to cast all Muslims as terrorists and by extension Sikhs. Political candidates are making it acceptable to discriminate against entire communities based on their religious beliefs. The FBI only in March of 2015 began tracking hate crimes specifically against Sikhs, following a strong lobbying campaign by the community.
The good news is we have a deep bench, and after 8 years of President Obama's economic policies, and quite frankly, foreign policy, people are going to be looking around. But if we don't pass immigration reform, if we don't get it off the table in a reasonable, practical way, it doesn't matter who you run in 2016. We're in a demographic death spiral as a party, and the only way we can get back in good graces with the Hispanic community, in my view, is pass comprehensive immigration reform. If you don't do that, it really doesn't matter who we run, in my view.
Lindsey Graham pointed out a few years ago that we do need to do something about immigration, and if we don't, then the Republicans, he was referring to his party there, the Republicans are not going to be able to gain office in 2016. And the Republicans refuse to do anything about immigration because there's a lot of racist people in that base. A lot of people who are driven by fear. Also, when you talk about folks taking jobs from Americans, you're talking about American employers who are giving jobs to lower paid workers. Now, the issues with Muslims and Sikhs doesn't really have a lot to do with immigration. Sikhs have been here for a long time, as have Muslims. But the extremist Muslims, those who are carrying out terrorist attacks because of the unending wars that we have been carrying out in the Middle East. If you go into war, any war, with at least somewhat of a clear objective, work to achieve that objective, and then have a plan for getting out of the country when it's done, okay. Acceptable. Let's go in, guns blazing, unending amounts of money being spent on it. That's not a good plan. I maintain, continue to maintain, that the number one reason that we go to war is not to keep America safe, but to keep these corporations that make money on war in the black. We don't create anything in America anymore. Most of the manufacturing that we do is war manufacturing. Planes, missiles, things of that nature, ships. And every state, if I'm not mistaken, has a place that manufactures these particular things. That keeps those states working to a degree. I've heard that the wealthiest zip code in America is in Washington, D.C. And why? Well, because that's where the head of a lot of these military contractors live. So it seems that the only thing that America makes anymore is war. When we employ people, it's for war. Send them overseas. War. Creating things that we use in war here. That's the only thing that America seems to make. And then when people say, where are all the jobs? We say, it's the brown people. And then when Muslims who are suffering immensely in the Middle East, either because of us or terror groups that we have helped create, we say, look, it's their fault. Okay, it's the Mexicans' fault. It's everybody else's fault. And now you can't turn on a radio, a television, open a magazine without seeing some kind of Muslim hate everywhere. And it's become completely okay to talk that way.
You know, when I see a woman walking around with a burqa, I see a Nazi. That's what I see. How do you like that? A hateful Nazi would like to cut your throat and kill your children. Don't give me this crap that they're doing it out of a sacred ritual or rite. It's not required by the Quran that a woman walk around in the 7th century drape. She's doing it to spit in your face. She's saying, you white moron, I'm going to kill you if I can. That's how I see it. What do you want me to do, mince words with you? I'm not going to mince words. We're too far gone in this country.
Michael Savage, who you just heard there, has millions of listeners. I didn't just catch him on a bad day when he was a little bit cranky. He says this kind of stuff all the time. And he has millions of dedicated listeners. He writes books, articles, and there are people that follow this man. And this is considered acceptable. This is considered okay because remember, it's their fault. It's not our fault. And then when things like this happen, it doesn't surprise anybody. Quote, the leader of a group of armed anti-Muslim protesters in Texas posted the addresses of dozens of local Muslims and, quote, Muslim sympathizers on his Facebook in November of 2015. David Wright III was behind an armed protest outside of a mosque in Irving, Texas, by a group called the Bureau on American-Islamic Relations, according to the Dallas Morning News. Wright prefaced the list of addresses, which appeared to be copied from a city document, by writing that those named stood up for Sharia tribunals. This hatred gets shared constantly in America right now, and it has led to actual beatings. It has led to actual assaults, and in some cases, it has even led to actual murders.
I want you to look me in the eye and tell me that I don't belong here. I want you to look me in the eye and tell me that my brother, a dental student at UNC, his bride Yusur of 6 weeks, also about to join him at UNC Dental, and her younger sister, who was visiting them for the afternoon, were worthy of those bullets because of their faith. When Trump says comments to the effect that Muslims are worthy of being killed with bullets dipped in pig's blood, then what you are essentially doing is saying that an entire group of people are worthy of violence. He's not realizing that those same words that are getting him points in the campaign are also ones that are leading to potentially lethal outcomes like they have in the case of my family.
Then Trump gets to claim ignorance. He gets to say, I didn't tell anybody to do anything bad. I'm not encouraging violence. What are you talking about? There's no violence in my rallies. I haven't said anything bad about Muslims.
How am I supposed to feel? I mean, my baby brother was murdered a year ago. 8 bullets. Was married 6 weeks prior to Yasser. 2 bullets. One in the hip, immobilizing her, and one in the back of her head, lacerating her midbrain. I read the autopsy reports. And one single shot into the back of Razan's head. Why? How is this acceptable? These were 3 American citizens, Muslim American university students, who were murdered in their home because of their faith. This is the acceptable racism of our time.
Quote, hate crimes committed against Muslims and mosques in the U.S. have tripled since the Paris terrorist attacks, according to an analysis from the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino and reviewed by the New York Times. I'm getting this from Talking Points Memo. I follow the Southern Poverty Law Center. And I think the fact that we even have the Southern Poverty Law Center is quite the statement. That already is too much hatred. But there are other groups around America, like this one in San Bernardino, that also tracks this kind of thing. There is so much of this hate that it is palpable and trackable. Quote, the terrorist attacks, coupled with the ubiquity of these anti-Muslim stereotypes seeping into the mainstream, have emboldened people to act upon this fear and anger. This according to Brian Levin, the center's director. According to the analysis, FBI data shows that in the past few years, there have been an average of 12.6 hate crimes against Muslims in the U.S. each month. But in December 2015, 38 anti-Muslim incidents have occurred. 18 of those incidents occurred after the San Bernardino shooting, according to the Times. Levin told the Times that they gathered data on the past month from news reports and civil rights groups. Attacks against Muslims following the San Bernardino shooting, including a woman throwing hot coffee at Muslims praying in a park and a man punching a Muslim store owner. Numerous mosques have also been vandalized or set on fire.
You said yesterday in a Facebook post that we need to empower law enforcement mm-hmm. to patrol and secure Muslim neighborhoods before they become radicalized. How would you define a Muslim neighborhood? Mm-hmm. Is there a certain percentage of Muslims that have to live there? Mm-hmm. And do you have to have any particular suspicion right. that they're being radicalized? Or is it just the mere fact that they're Muslims, in your mind, means police officers should be securing and patrolling those areas?
Whenever there's an incident where the perpetrator is white, we call him a lone wolf, an isolated incident, just another isolated incident. But when the person is of color, especially when the person is Muslim, the opportunists on right-wing radio and on Fox News and on the right-wing blogs and over at Alex Jones and all these other hate merchants, and that's exactly what they are, they're hate merchants. All of these hate merchants dive right in, and we quickly forget our history with respect to this kind of thing. Anti-Muslim patrols, or if you don't want to call them that, Muslim patrols. What in the holy hell is wrong with you? And we're not talking about the Republican frontrunner right now, we're talking about the current runner-up.
Mayor de Blasio, in an example of political correctness very befitting of Obama and Hillary Clinton, canceled the program, said we're not going to target the bad guys because they will not acknowledge.
You cite that program, but yeah. it, of course, has yeah. been disbanded. And a former supervisor of that mm-hmm. program said that in 6 years, it never led to even one piece of intelligence, mm-hmm. not an arrest, not a conviction. In fact, this supervisor was quoted as saying that it involved paying undercover officers to sit in cafes frequented by Muslims, drinking tea and eating sweets at taxpayer expense.
That was Ted Cruz on the Today Show. And what she's trying to point out there is right. There was a program, and it cost quite a bit of money. And all it did was drive a wedge between the city and the Muslims that live within the city. There are thousands of Muslims in New York City. New York City is like a microcosm of the planet. You've got people from all over the world there. All types are there. And when you have something like that, that's an entire community of people that doesn't feel like they can trust the police. Somebody that doesn't feel like they can trust their city. Somebody that doesn't feel like they can trust their government. So that was your runner-up. Do we even need to ask how the current GOP frontrunner feels?
As you know, Ted Cruz suggested today the U.S. should step up its involvement going into Muslim neighborhoods, as he described it, looking for potential terrorists. Is that something you would support?
Yes, I would. I think that's a good idea.
I'm talking about Muslim neighborhoods in the United States, for example.
Yeah, I would support that, yes, 100%.
But how would you do that? How do you find out where Muslim neighborhoods are?
You do it. You do it. Let me tell you, I bet you the local police know much more than what's going on than anybody would understand.
How do you do it? You just do it. You do it. How do you do it? We're just going to do it. What do you mean we're going to... Hey, the police, they know something. What he means to say is brown people. What he means to say is folks with beards. What he means to say is folks with head wraps. He says, you just start watching those people because those are the people that are doing everything wrong. And I understand that these candidates think that our media doesn't reach the entire nation. Bigger and better than that. They think that it doesn't reach the entire world. And they think that they're just saying hateful, racist things, right? Things that are against other cultures, things that are against other religions, and all it's going to do is help them in their campaign because they're trying to get elected by a bunch of racists, trying to get elected by a bunch of xenophobes, and they think that it's not going to reach beyond our shores. I give you Donald Trump appearing in an ISIS propaganda video.
America, I have this to say. Slowly but surely, your situation is becoming similar to that of the embattled Muslim community of Spain after the fall of Granada. Muslims of the West, take heed and learn from the lessons of history. There are ominous clouds gathering in your horizon. Yesterday, America was a land of slavery, segregation, lynching, and Ku Klux Klan. And tomorrow, it will be a land of religious discrimination and concentration camps.
And so remember this, so listen. Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what is going on.
The West will eventually turn against its Muslim citizens.
It was interesting that in that particular video, they bleeped out the word hell. Donald Trump says, until we figure out what the hell is going on. That kind of thing isn't okay in their videos, but the beheadings and that stuff is just fine. The bigger part, the worst part, is that the words of the GOP frontrunners right now, you don't have Bernie Sanders appearing in ISIS videos. You don't have Hillary Clinton appearing in these videos that ISIS makes to recruit people, but you do have Ted Cruz. You do have Donald Trump, and that's demonstrable. So what do we do? Here's what we can do. We can prove them wrong. We cannot treat our Muslim brothers and sisters in America with that kind of hatred and with that kind of suspicion. We can decide not to attack our brothers and sisters of the Muslim religion here in America. People inside of America, people who have grown up in America, lived their entire lives in America. We can decide not to go after them. We can decide not to use anti-Muslim rhetoric. But what instead do we do? The point of terrorism is to sow fear. What happened in San Bernardino was a terrorist attack. That fear was sown, and now America did what it generally does in this situation. Gets uber scared and carries out terrorist attacks of its own. This from Talking Points Memo. December 4th, the windows were smashed out at a Palm Beach Islamic Center. December 4th, a man threatened to cut off a Muslim's head. A man left numerous threatening voicemails at the Council on Islamic Relations in St. Louis mentioning the attack in San Bernardino. He threatened to cut off Muslims' heads if they came to his home. The FBI reportedly arrested a suspect, but he may not be charged. There's a huge list of attacks. Just in the days following the San Bernardino Muslim attack, a Muslim store owner punched by a man who yelled, "I kill Muslims." A Muslim congressman received a death threat. Muslim Representative Andre Carson, Democrat from Indiana, said that he received a death threat. A Sikh temple was vandalized in California. Remember, not a Muslim. A man threw stones at a Muslim woman's car. December 6th, Woman threw hot coffee at Muslims praying in a park, December 7th. Man asked restaurant workers if they are Muslim and then slapped one of the employees. December 8th, a pig's head found outside of a Philadelphia mosque. Which reminds me, we talked about it on this show after it came out. I think it came out of Idaho, which is also where the Klan is. The Jihog bullets. Do you remember this? These were bullets that you could buy that were dipped in pig's blood. Load them into your, you know, your chosen murder weapon. Kill Muslims with them. And the idea was, because based on their religion, because they don't consume pork, that the pig's blood would make them unclean and that they wouldn't go to heaven. But it's really just a hate on America's part. December 7th, New Jersey mosque receives hateful letters. A mosque received several hateful letters, one which called Muslims evil. December 9th, passengers attack rideshare driver in Seattle. December 9th, man calls woman trash and kicks her in the leg. C-A-I-R receives hate mail with an unknown substance in it on December 10th. Same day, vandals broke windows at a Phoenix mosque. Same day, man set fire to a Somali restaurant. Same day, a woman Muslim's car shot at while she was leaving a mosque. On the same day, a Muslim family had windows of a house smashed out multiple times, according to CBS Dallas-Fort Worth. And the list goes on. I'm not even halfway through it. Some members of the media have spoken out about this. Not conservatives, but folks that that you might be able to consider liberal, or people who are just members of the media who don't work at Fox News or Breitbart or any of these. Jorge Ramos went on with Sean Hannity and pointed out how he is just giving Trump a pass on this and that Trump is a stone-cold racist. This should be where the right-wing media is stepping in and saying, you know what, we do have a problem here. We are making this worse. These attacks on Muslims, yes, Fox News has blood on its hands. Sean Hannity, blood on your hands. Alex Jones, blood on your hands. Not that you matter, or not that it matters to you at all, although it should.
I like Jorge Ramos. He's no phony, but he is absolutely blind on the Trump issue. And he has no bleeping clue about what we do here, obviously. Maybe Jorge objects because I will not brand Donald Trump a racist. He's not. He doesn't care what color or race somebody is.
Which is exactly why the white knights are showing up to his rallies and are phone banking for him and are doing robocalls for Donald Trump. Because he's clearly not a racist. Why would you think that he's a racist?
Do you understand, though, the concerns that people have there could be someone who could slip in with the refugees? How confident are you of the systems that are put in place, whether it's the 8 Syrian refugees who turn themselves in at the border in Laredo, Texas, to the systems that bring people into this country more formally for resettlement? What people on the other side of this argument say is there is no 100% guarantee, and that 1% is what makes them afraid.
Well, and there is never a 100% guarantee. And safety is my number one concern, as it is Governor Abbott's. We've got to make sure they're safe. This is a 21-step process to get in, 18 to 24 months to jump through these hoops. This is a serious issue. I am more fearful of large gatherings of young white men that come into schools, theaters, and shoot people up, but we don't isolate young white men on this issue.
Then here we are, America the brave, afraid of everything up to and including our own shadows. With the violence that Syria has seen recently, which is brought on by any number of things, ISIS for one, global warming for another, our president, as well as the president of a lot of other countries, said that maybe we should start bringing some of these refugees here. And immediately, the right-wing media seized on it. They saw it as an opportunity to help spread more fear amongst their already frightened base. And they said, look, if we're going to bring them here, well, how do you know that Al-Qaeda isn't going to slip in with them? How do you know that ISIS isn't going to slip in with them? The most effective way that Daesh recruits, that ISIS recruits, is on the internet. It's not a problem for them to bring people in on the internet. They take these young men, and I watched a documentary about this recently that was hosted by Sanjay Gupta, and he says, you take these young men who have no direction in life, who have no hope in life, who have never held a girl's hand, and you tell them that you will give them a wife, that you will give them a weapon, you will give them food, you will give them money, you will give them security, and it's not hard to bring these men in. That works in countries overseas, and that works right here in America, and that work is done over the internet. These videos that they have on the internet are very slickly produced. They really look like Hollywood blockbusters. They've got guys working on this stuff that are absolutely capital, and it really draws people in. If you think people don't do what their television tells them to do, if you think the people do not worship what their television tells them to worship, look at Donald Trump. Donald Trump doesn't have any plans. Donald Trump doesn't have any policy prescriptions. Donald Trump doesn't have a vision for the future of America. He has slogans. We're going to win at everything. I love everything. We're going to make America great again. We're going to be the best ever. You're going to get sick of winning. He doesn't have any actual positions. He doesn't have any actual plans, and he's winning because his run for president is really just an extension of his reality television show. And so the idea that somebody's going to go through that long process as a refugee, it's going to take them 3 years to sneak in, or 2 years to sneak in, or ISIS could just produce another really slick looking video. Lots of flashy graphics, explosions, and all kinds of things like that. And things that make the life in a terrorist organization look very attractive and have boys here in America who also have no clear path in life, have no direction, who feel isolated, who don't understand the world. Those boys are prime to be picked by ISIS. And all of this fear about Muslims and Muslim terrorism, this according to Think Progress, you are 7 times more likely to be killed by a right-wing extremist than by a Muslim terrorist. Remember, we don't call it terrorism if it happens by a white guy, especially if it's a white guy with a gun. Quote, though terrorism perpetrated by Muslims receives a disproportionate amount of attention from politicians and reporters, the reality is that right-wing extremists pose a much greater threat to people in the United States than terrorists connected to ISIS or similar organizations. As UNC professor Charles Kurzman and Duke professor David Shanzer explained last June in the New York Times, Islam-inspired terror attacks accounted for 50 fatalities over the past 13 and a half years. Meanwhile, remember, 50. Meanwhile, right-wing extremists averaged 337 attacks per year in the decade after 9/11, causing a total of 254 fatalities. Kurzman and Shanzer's mythology, moreover, may underestimate the degree to which domestic terrorists in the United States are motivated by right-wing views. As they describe the term in their New York Times piece, the term right-wing extremist primarily encompasses anti-government extremists, such as members of the Sovereign Citizen Movement, although it also includes racist right-wing groups such as the neo-Nazis. Kurzman and Shanzer also surveyed hundreds of law enforcement agencies regarding their assessment of various threats. Of the 382 agencies they spoke with, 74% reported anti-government extremism as one of the top three terrorist threats in their jurisdiction, while only 39% listed extremism connected with Al-Qaeda or like-minded terrorist organizations. So to Fox News, to Bill O'Reilly, to Donald Trump, to Ted Cruz, all of you get to be very, very proud because you're not just helping create extremists in the Middle East. You're also creating extremists with white people born in America, here at home. White people who are afraid of everything and don't understand why they're afraid of everything or even what they're afraid of. And they too are carrying out terrorist attacks. Mayor de Blasio and Chief Bill Bratton were both asked at a press conference about Ted Cruz's proposed Muslim patrols. And they didn't pull any punches.
His comments are not about safety and security. It's demagoguery. We have 900 Muslim American officers in the NYPD. We have peace-loving, law-abiding Muslim Americans in neighborhoods all over New York City. They should be respected like all other members of our community. So the question is, if any individual might commit a crime, if any individual might commit an act of terror, we're going to be all over them. And again, NYPD has extraordinary ability to deal with any threat or any lead. But to paint an entire community with that brush is absolutely counterproductive. By the way, it's immoral. It does not conform with American values, but it's also counterproductive. It's a great way to alienate thousands and thousands of people and make them feel like they don't belong in this country, and that's not good for anyone.
Since Obama has become president, And remember, when he came into office, we were losing 700,000 to 800,000 jobs a month. We've now created over 14 million jobs. Stock market's gone back up. Home prices have gone back up. More and more people are employed. And for the first time in decades, wages are now starting to go up. But the Republicans would very much like to be your president. So they're on the campaign trail. They're telling everybody how awful America is, what's wrong with America, how bad your life has been over the last 8 years, and how much worse it's going to get. And the only way they can get people to vote for them is by scaring the hell out of them. They tell them about how awful the economy is, but it doesn't pan out. They tell them how awful their future is going to be, and people have their doubts. But they can say, hey, remember, terrorism is everywhere. There is right-wing terrorism and there's Muslim terrorism, and they just conflate the two and try to tell you that everything is Muslim terrorism. Chief Bill Bratton.
I would remind the senator he lives in the United States of America. And the statements he made today is why he's not going to become president of this country. Because we don't need a president that doesn't respect the values that form the foundation of this country. As the mayor mentioned, I have over 900 very dedicated officers in this department, many of whom do double duty. They serve as active duty members of the U.S. military in combat, something the senator has never seen. So before he starts denigrating any population group, take a close look at who he's denigrating. I take great offense at his characterization of that whole population, particularly with my intimacy with the population in my organization of Muslim officers who are willing to sacrifice their lives in foreign countries and every day step up willing to sacrifice their lives here.
David Briggs writes the Ahead of the Trend column for the Association of Religion Data Archives. And he recently wrote an article for Huffington Post titled, A Nation Divided by Fear, Studies Reveal How and Why We Target Muslims and Immigrants. Quote, 56% of Americans believe houses or rooms can be haunted. One in five believes Bigfoot is a real creature, and about the same percentage are afraid of zombies. Fears can become toxic, research finds, when they turn groups of people against one another, breaking down the sense of social trust that enables nations and communities to work together for a common good. America may be nearing such a critical tipping point. A new set of studies surveying fears in 2014 and 2015 offers insight into how much we are afraid of one another. Here are some key findings from the Chapman Survey of American Fears. Almost twice as many Americans say you cannot be too careful in life as opposed to saying most people can be trusted. Among young adults, nearly three times as many were more likely to be careful than trusting. Half of Americans said that they are at least somewhat afraid of people they don't know. Fewer than half said they would feel safe helping a stranger who ran out of gas on the side of the road. Nearly 4 in 10 Americans in the Chapman study said immigration brings diseases into the country and illegal immigrants are more likely to commit crimes than U.S. citizens. By a significant margin, Americans have the warmest feelings towards whites, with a rating of 74 on the feeling thermometer scale in the study. Way down at the bottom, below even immigrants, and just slightly ahead of atheists are Muslims, with a rating of 50 on the scale. A nearly threefold increase in hate crimes against Muslims and mosques is evidence that they make easy targets. Politicians who would not dare target majority groups in the same manner float proposals such as banning all Muslims who want to enter the country. When we get too careful, we tend to get more emotional than logical. And you can actually create that threat that you fear, this according to Chapman sociologist Chris Bader, a lead study researcher. What the Chapman studies help us understand is how our fears can override reason when they touch on deeper parts of the human psyche. These include fears of things Americans perceive as beyond their control, such as government advances in technology. So in the 2015 Chapman study, despite little evidence of major scandals, the greatest fear was government corruption, with 58% saying that they are very afraid of such malfeasance. The next two top fears were cyber terrorism and corporate tracking of personal data, followed closely by fear of a terrorist attack. Deeply ingrained fears of the other reveal themselves in the latter, though, and this is what's important to this. The other. When we talk about Muslims, we're creating the other. When we talk about welfare recipients, we're creating the other. And we're trying to make people afraid of the other. So what is the other? Nobody really consciously understands what the other is. But they have some ideas. It may have been white men who blew up the federal building with a daycare inside of it in Oklahoma City, or who shot up a school in Newtown, Connecticut, or more recently committed mass murder in a church in Charleston, South Carolina, which, by the way, according to a report, was an attempt to start a race war. But those atrocities are largely interpreted as I was saying earlier, individual acts of terrorism. And sometimes they're not even considered terrorism because they were carried out by white people. How many people were killed in the building in Oklahoma City? 160 some? Why is that not terrorism? Oh, right, because a white guy did it. So, how can we build social trust and become a safer society? First, research suggests that we have to realize that it's not going to be easy. It's not only cultural, but genetic traits that lead us to fear others outside of our group. Be not afraid and love your neighbor as yourself may be clarion calls of scripture for the nation's majority faith, but in the Chapman study, mainline Protestants, evangelicals, and Catholics all expressed less warmth toward Muslims than the general public. Education needs to be a priority. Helping people become aware of and understand the psychological mechanisms behind hatred may open doors to reason, compassion, and an awareness of what can be the absurdity of human antipathy towards other groups. This, according to researcher Willem Machiner at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. If human feelings of enmity and are innate and spontaneous, they are not infinitely strong. It is possible to overcome them, but people need a reason to do it, she writes. There's always fear of the other, the people we don't understand, the people who are different from us, she said. Let's not have our fears create a more dangerous world. So a more dangerous world, as is pointed out, is not necessarily being created by more dangerous people, but it's being created by us. The fear that we spread, the fear that our politicians like to spread. In particular, the fear that our right-wing politicians are guilty of spreading.
Obama has no strategy to defeat ISIS, and now he's preparing to let hundreds of thousands of refugees from Syria into the United States. I will stop illegal immigration. We'll build a wall on the southern border, and yes, I will also quickly and decisively bomb the hell out of ISIS. We'll rebuild our military and make it so strong, no one, and I mean no one, will mess with us. If I win, we will not have to listen to the politicians who are losing the war on terrorism. We will keep America safe, and we will make America great again.
Apparently, this is a guy who knows how to quickly and decisively defeat ISIS, but he's not going to let us in on it. He did, however, point out again that he was going to build a wall, the greatest wall ever, because his walls are the greatest. Everything's going to be so great. I'm going to make America great again. So I've wondered, what does the current or former president of Mexico think about Trump's wall? Perhaps they've spoken out about it. They've both said that the wall isn't going to be built, but the former president of Mexico put it in much more stark terms.
I'm not going to pay for that wall.
Yeah, I had to edit a cuss word out of that. He minced no words.
I'm not going to pay for that wall.
There is another thing that, although right-wing politicians won't say it, it is one of the things that ends up happening. And that is that spreading this kind of hatred, this kind of rhetoric, can also create a nice paramilitary for your right-wing campaign, for your white power campaign, when you use that kind of dog whistle language.
When he is playing funny with the Klan, that is not cool.
He didn't play funny.
Hold on a second. I know this man when he gets passionate about terrorism. I know how he talks about terrorism. The Klan is a terrorist organization that has killed...
A leftist terrorist organization.
You can put whatever label you want. That's your game to play.
No, that's your game to play.
No, they're not. We're not going to play that game.
We're not going to understand history.
No. You need to take a serious look at the fact that this man is playing fast and loose and footsie. When you talk about terrorism, he gets passionate. He says, no, this is wrong. But when you talk about the Klan, I don't know. That's wrong. And then you came on the air. And you said, well, this is just like when Reverend Wright was speaking.
Yeah.
Reverend Wright never lynched anybody. Reverend Wright never killed anybody.
Reverend Wright is an anti-Semite.
Reverend Wright never put anybody on a post. And you guys play these word games. And it's wrong to do in America.
It is wrong to understand that these are not leftists. They were a
what, the, what difference does it make if you call them
a lot of difference, man.
They're going chipmunks. They've killed people.
We're not,
and you don't play games with that.
We are, you're right. And you don't hide and say that's not part of the base of the Democratic Party. That has been, they were the military arm, the terrorist arm of the Democratic Party, according to historians.
The white guy that you hear there calling the KKK a terrorist group for leftists, his name is Jeffrey Lord. He used to work for Ronald Reagan. The other gentleman that you hear making good points is Van Jones. Every night that there's election coverage, these two guys are on, as well as a few others. And Jeffrey Lord loves trying to say that the KKK is actually a leftist group, which it is not, because they're clearly coming out for Donald, but they used to be. Yeah, that was when there were the Dixiecrats, who are not the modern-day Democratic Party. The modern-day Republican Party, those are your Dixiecrats. Those are your Confederates. So there's a group, this is from an article from last September, called the Indomitables. Southern secessionist group forming paramilitary unit called the Indomitables. This according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. After years of rhetoric threatening violence, the neo-Confederate League of the South is training uniformed paramilitary unit tasked with advancing a second Southern secession by any means necessary. According to anonymous sources from within the LOS, as well as leaked internal communications, the LOS secret unit had been dubbed the Indomitables and appears to be stacked with white supremacists and former Klan members and neo-Nazis. The Indomitables were conceptualized at an LOS meeting in 2015 and appear to be coming online very quickly, with Floyd Eric Meadows, 43, of Rome, Georgia, who goes by Eric Thorvaldsen online, in charge of training, according to sources within the group and internal documents. A veteran of both U.S. Army and Navy with 12 years of service, Meadows has been an active LOS member for several years, and his personal Facebook account is filled with pagan iconography and photos of his weapons. He posts often about earning his red bootlaces, which are awarded in skinhead culture for drawing blood for the movement, and his desire to throw boot parties for enemies of the LOS. Meadows has posted pictures of himself standing with assault rifles in front of a Confederate flag for those who want to say that the Confederate flag is not racist, and has frequently quoted Robert Barnwell Rhett, a South Carolina statesman who was dubbed the father of secession, for his efforts leading up to the Civil War. Telephone messages regarding the Indomitables, specifically to ask how and where the League hopes to use the unit, and to what end. They were not returned, but within a day those messages being left, Hill addressed the question on the LOS blog. Even if we are, and you really have no idea on earth if we are or are not setting up a Southern militia or other form of paramilitary organization, we are doing nothing that free men have not done for centuries. Deal with it and stop your whining, he wrote. He goes on, the primary targets will not be enemy soldiers. Instead, they will be political leaders, members of the hostile media, cultural icons, bureaucrats, and other of the managerial elite without whom the engines of tyranny don't run. He concluded the essay by quoting Psalms. Blessed be my Lord, the strength who teaches my hands to war and my fingers to fight. The word indomitable means impossible to defeat or discourage.
Now here's the other problem with it. Not only is it, I think, not the right thing, not the American thing to try to close the doors to our country, but it's actually tactically a mistake, because Daesh, also known as ISIS, this terrorist group is trying to argue that the West, the United States included, is merciless, that they are against Muslims. And this is not true. It's not true at all. But if we allow them to scare us into closing our doors, they will use that to say to the refugees, see, we told you, these people don't want you, and they don't care that you're suffering. They will use that message to recruit, and they will use that message to advance their cause. I don't believe we should do that.
And remember, the number one way that they recruit is not by throwing people over the wall, not by sending people over the border. It's over the internet.
We are leading the world against these terrorist networks, whereas some of my opponents want to build walls and shut the world off. Well, you tell me, how high does the wall have to be to keep the internet out? Right? You know, that's not the world we live in any longer.
The headline over on Raw Story by Joshua Holland is one Southerner says the Confederacy was a con job on white people and its legacy still is today. Before I get into this article, I want to play this clip from Tim Wise regarding the kind of hatred that we've talked about for almost the last hour now.
When we look around and we see today in our politics, a rich white man telling working class white people that their problem is brown people, we need to understand the historical pedigree of that. That is symbolic of the entire history of race and class politics in America. The history of rich white people telling working class and poor white people that their problem are black and brown people. So beginning in the 1600s, that is what happens. Prior to about 1670 or so, there was no such thing as the white race, at least not recognized as such, called as such. That is not what people of European descent were when they were in Europe. They were English, they were Irish, they were Scottish, they were whatever they were. They were not white. Only in the colonies do we become white, and for a very specific reason, because in those early years of the colonial period, where you had white indentured servants, one level above enslaved themselves, and you had African-descended folks, some of them enslaved for life, others indentured servants also in the earliest years of the colonies, those people would often see their interests as being common. They all realized that they were being screwed over by the same landowners, the same elite. They fomented various rebellions, like Bacon's Rebellion in Virginia, others as well. And as a result, the elite in the colonies realized that they had to figure out a way to get the other folks from Europe on their team. So they created this mentality that said, you're now a member of the white race. You're on our team. You're wearing our uniform. Now you're at the end of the bench. You may not get in the game, but you're on our team, you see. So then they start putting white folks, now called, on the slave patrols, right? Didn't really give them any land or any real power except the power to control people of color, which is why folks of color say, and they are right, that modern policing traces to the system of slave patrols and slavery. And we have to be clear on that because that's the history, right? So whiteness was created to divide and conquer, to create the notion that even though you might not have much, at least you're not black, at least you're not indigenous, at least you're not Mexican, at least you're not Chinese working on the railroads to build the transcontinental economy. You may not have much, but at least you have, as W.E.B. Du Bois said, the psychological wage of whiteness.
Joshua Holland at Raw Story asks Frank Hyman, you say the Confederacy was a con job on whites then and now. Didn't white Southerners profit immensely from the slavery prior to the Civil War? Frank Hyman, yes, but most of the profit then, as now, went to the one percenters, people at the top of the pile. About a third of Southern families did own slaves, so it was pretty widespread, but there were plenty of families that might own one or two enslaved Africans. They weren't wealthy. The bulk of slaves were owned by the top 5% or 10% of Southern families.
It's a trick that was played during the Civil War era on my people in the South, right? Rich folk, landowners in the South telling poor white folks who didn't own anything that they got to go out and fight to preserve the rich man's property in human beings. Fascinating. Why would you do that? Why would I go fight for your property? Well, because you told me that if I don't, these slaves are going to take my job. No fool, they got your job. That's the point. If you got to charge a dollar a day and you can make them work for free because you own them, guess who got the gig, Jack? Not you. So in fact, the system of enslavement was in the long run against the class interest of working class white folks, but they got suckered. Same thing happened in the union movement. You had white labor union folks who didn't want black and brown bodies in their union because it would reduce the professionalism of the craft. No fool, it'll double the size of your union. Then when you go out on strike, they can't replace your happy ass with the brown folk that you didn't want next to you in the first place. Because when they do replace you with them, then you will blame them, not the elite. See how that works? It's a trick. And it has worked for hundreds of years. It is working on some folk right now. And it is our job to resist that with every fiber of our being.
Joshua Holland. So it was very unequal, yet even poor whites fought and died to preserve the institution of slavery. There's a personal angle for you here, right? He's asking, yes, because remember, we fought the Civil War over slavery. Quote, yeah, Kenna Hyman was one of my kinsmen from that era, he says. This is Frank Hyman. He and his two sons were in the field, and a note from our family history says someone came in for them while they were plowing one day. They put their horses up and all three went away to war, and only one son, William, came back. Two of them died, one of them came back. Quote, if you owned a certain number of slaves, you didn't have to go to war. Certainly sounds a lot like it does now, doesn't it? Recently, Elizabeth Warren criticized Donald Trump. And Donald Trump was asked about it. And even with this particular question, he could not help but be racist.
Elizabeth Warren today on social media went after you, calling you a loser. How are you going? Are you
the Indian? You mean the Indian?
Are you prepared to deal with that kind of sustained attack from both sides?
The Indian, meaning the Indian, and this has been a slam on her for a while because she has Indian in her blood. And they tried to say that she got herself into a prestigious college by putting that down on an application. And Stuart Varney and Ed Klein went off on Hillary Clinton when she was decrying the racism and hatred in the campaign. Went off on her. How dare she decry this?
What Americans are hearing on the campaign trail this year is something else entirely. Encouraging violence, playing coy with white supremacists, calling for 12 million immigrants to be rounded up and deported, demanding we turn away refugees because of their religion, and proposing a ban on all Muslims entering the United States. If you see bigotry, oppose it. If you see violence, condemn it. If you see a bully, stand up to him.
Ed, she said she opposes religious bigotry,
yes,
the imposition of a ban on a temporary ban on Muslims coming into America. 12 hours later, you get this horrendous attack in Europe.
Exactly.
I don't think she looks that good.
No, she doesn't. She does not look good at all. In fact, I would say that this plays into Donald's effort to present himself as the strong man. That he's going to get things done. He's going to close mosques here in the United States. He's going to stop immigration from Muslims. He's going to wipe out ISIS. She doesn't say any of these things. I think this is definitely a tipping point in this race.
Some of us are working towards a more positive world. Some of us are working towards a more positive country, your humble host included. Not all of us are working for hatred. Even folks who cannot vote for Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton in the upcoming campaign are still working for them. This is a clip from MSNBC about the Bernie Dreamers.
We're in Vegas. This is one of Bernie Sanders' campaign offices in Nevada. I'm here to talk to somebody who is spending her time and energy volunteering for the campaign, even though she's not going to be able to vote for Bernie Sanders on election day.
An obvious and simple question is, you're a dreamer, you're undocumented, so you can't vote.
I cannot, no.
So what are you doing here working for a guy running to be president when you can't vote for him?
Get my friends to go out and vote. Get my friends to go out and caucus. Remind them. And they know that in order for me to get ahead, this is really important for me and my family.
How many people do you think there are like you, dreamers, undocumented Americans that are volunteering for presidential campaigns?
There's a lot. There's a lot of folks, undocumented folks, working with campaigns too.
Majid Nawaz used to be a radicalized Muslim who spent some time in prison, and while he was in there, saw the light on Islamic terrorism and realized how awful it is. He got out, he turned his life around, and now he runs Quilliam International, which is a group that is working to educate people about the extremism in the Muslim world and working against it. And as such, Majid Nawaz gets a lot of death threats. Running the organization has ruined his life, but it's become critically important to him because he's been on both sides of this. He has seen the hatred. It's become critically important to him to see the world become a better place and to see this kind of extremism defeated.
If you're doing what I do and attempting to turn the tide of Islamist extremism that has come to dominate the discourse within Muslim communities because they shout the loudest and they threaten the loudest, and familial ties are made and broken over this ideology, then of course every single day you have to second guess yourself, because is it worth it? Is it worth it to lose a marriage, to speak in favor of rights of others? Look, I speak in the favor of gay Muslims, feminist Muslims, ex-Muslims, and minority sects such as the Shia, none of which I am. And so of course every day I have to question whether that is worth losing family over. My brother is incredibly upset with what I'm doing and hasn't spoken to me for a long time. My ex-wife left me, and as you've just mentioned, I haven't seen my son. And it's a very, very difficult thing, because one has to question, am I being stubborn? Can I just let somebody else do this? Do I have to be the one that speaks in this way?
And how do you answer that?
What I know is that since I've been doing this for 8 years, people have joined my organization, other voices have emerged, but I'm still needed to raise funds for my organization. It's a non-profit. I provide work for people whose full-time job it is to engage in the reform debate within Muslim communities. They are theologians, they are ex-Islamists, they are ex-jihadists, they are feminist Muslims, and feminist Muslim theologians as well. And they all have left their full-time jobs to do this work, and I pay their salaries through my organization. And so if I take a back seat, all of that falls apart. And so I wonder, if I do sit to the side, who's going to fill that void?
There's a Muslim anchor that works on Australian TV. And after some of the recent attacks, he decided to go on the air and point out how we are doing the work of ISIS for them. And what would be a better way to defeat ISIS? And by the way, it's not talking tough that's going to defeat ISIS.
We all need to come together. I know how that sounds. I know it's a cliche, but it's also true, because it's exactly what ISIL doesn't want. So if you're a member of parliament or a has-been member of parliament preaching hate at a time when what we actually need is more love, you're helping ISIL. They have told us that. If you're a Muslim leader telling your community they have no place here, or a non-Muslim basically saying the same thing, you're helping ISIL. They have told us that. Or if you're just someone with a Facebook or Twitter account firing off misguided missives of hate, you're helping ISIL. They've told us that.
It's hard to say what's going to happen in 5 or even 10 years from now. It's hard to say how all of this is going to shake out. But we don't fight fear with more fear. We don't fight these battles by being confused and by going after one another and spreading hatred. That's never going to work for us. You have to reject hatred. You have to reject xenophobia. And you have to do your best to, at the very least, understand either your enemy or your perceived enemy. I spend a lot of time with this stuff, and I don't necessarily have all the answers. But I do have this. After reading all the things I've read, after listening to all the things I've listened to, after seeing all the things that I've seen, it gets my wheels turning. I hope today's episode also got your wheels turning. What can you do? I do this because I believe that I am good at this. I speak out against this hatred anytime that I can. But what would you be good at? How can you add to this fight? My apologies for doing such a long episode today, but this is a really important thing to me. This particular subject gets to my core, and we have to understand what happens when we treat other groups like this in history. It doesn't turn out well. It doesn't turn out well for us. And it doesn't turn out well for them. And although I do not know exactly what to do next, I do know a good starting place. We can come together, we can talk about this stuff, and we can understand this stuff. And, as Lindsey Graham said,
you know how you make America great again? Tell Donald Trump to go to hell.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. You can also find our show over at kiwistation.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Kiwi also has an app at both stores. Individual episodes are available at the iTunes Store or on Podbean. Just search for The Fire You Can Put Out. You can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, or hate mail, or just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base, so feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are The Fire You Can Put Out, and we will prevail. Rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and thanks to you for listening. Also, thank you to Kiwi Station. This is Melvin, signing off. Now that I've woken you up, good morning.